Since the body is a great city, there must be various engagement arrangements such as lakes and gardens for sense enjoyment. Of the various parts of the body, those which incite sexual impulses are referred to here indirectly. Because the body has genitals, when the living entity attains the right age, be he man or woman, he becomes agitated by the sex impulse. As long as one remains a child, he is not agitated by seeing a beautiful woman. Although the sense organs are present, unless the age is right, there is no sex impulse. The favourable conditions surrounding the sex impulse are compared here to a garden or a nice solitary park. When one sees the opposite sex, naturally the sex impulse increases. It is said that if a man in a solitary place does not become agitated upon seeing a woman, he is considered to be a brahmachari. But this practice is almost impossible. The sex impulse is so strong that even by seeing, touching or talking, coming into contact with, or even thinking of the opposite sex, even in so many subtle ways, one becomes sexually impelled. Consequently, brahmachari sannyasi is prohibited to associate with women, especially in a secret place. The Sanskrit enjoined that one should not even talk to a woman in a secret place, even if she happens to be one's own daughter, sister, or mother. The sex impulse is so strong that even if one is very learned, he becomes agitated in such circumstances. If this is the case, how can a young man in a nice park remain calm and quiet after seeing a beautiful young woman? Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we put in this verse in context. We're discussing King Arjuna, and we know that Arjuna is a Sanskrit word indicating the body and the occupier of the body. So this verse, therefore, this whole section, this whole story presented by Radharani is a expansion of the teachings that we give in the Bhagavad Gita about this essential aspect of knowledge. Because Krishna describes in the Bhagavad Gita that knowledge consists of this. The field of activities, which is the body, and the knower of the field of activities. So there are 8,400,000 different species of life, and each of them has a particular body, and each individual soul, that body is their field of activities. And they are, because they're a spirit soul, they're different from the body, which is like the dress, which can be changed. One can go from one species of life to another. So that knower of the body is the eternal spirit soul. But there are two knowers in the body, and the other knower is the super soul, who is the knower of all bodies. He is omnipresent, the Supreme Lord. And he is the... So although in one sense the living entity, the spirit soul, is the being the null of the body and being superior to matter, he is acting as the purusha, the enjoyer, although that's somewhat of a false position, because the actual enjoyer is the supernova or the Supreme Lord, who is the actual proprietor, and actually the living entity is in fact the joy or one of the energies of the Lord, all of which are expanding the bliss of the Supreme Lord. So, so one should know the field of activities, the knower of body, consisting of the soul and the Supreme Soul, and understand that actually the Supreme Soul is the actual enjoyer and the actual proprietor. And the spirit soul is somewhat has a little knowledge of the field of activities and a little ownership. And so this is described in many different places. So, for instance, in the Bhagavad Gita, another analogy which helps to understand it is mentioned in in text 14 of the 5th chapter, it describes na kachitam kamni lokasya sri prabhu na kama pala samyogam subhavastu pravartate The embodied spirit, master of the city of his body. So again, we're seeing this analogy that the body, which, as I say, this whole Bhagavatam chapter is expanding this understanding that we can compare the body to a city. So now, he's called the master of the city of his body, the Prabhu. As we said, that there is a higher Prabhu, that's the super soul, the real Prabhu. That master of the city of the body does not create activities, nor does he induce people to act, nor does he create the fruits of action. All this is enacted by the modes of material nature. So, therein we see that many concepts there, but the initial thing to understand is that the body can be compared to a city. And that helps us to see our position. So, for instance, all of us have a home in the city of Melbourne, and we understand that we may rent a property, some of us may even own a property, but ultimately it's the government who owns everything and controls everything. So if they decide they're going to put a freeway through your home, you have to move. And you have to sell. For instance, in the Middle East, we see that for decades, centuries, someone says, well, this part of Syria, I have my home here, and then someone comes in, the government says, well, we're the government, you have to leave it. And they just have to leave in hundreds of thousands. And they can never come back. Some of them, they let them come back. And another government comes in. Now we're the owners. You all get out. You all get out. And then sometimes they let them back in. And another government comes. You all get out. So, this body is like that. That it is a city, but there is a supreme proprietor, and when he says get out, you have to get out. And that is called death. Yeah. So therefore we have a certain amount of control, but now the interesting thing is that in the Bhagavad Gita, the third chapter, text 27, under the influence of false ego and in ignorance, because we're all in ignorance, born in ignorance, we don't know the difference between the body and ourself. We take ourself as the body, then one thing. We don't know that there is a soul that is transmigrating from one body to another according to one's desires and karma. We don't know that. And we also, even if some try to have some inkling that the self is different from the body, they may not exactly know the nature of the self. Some may think that, as the body deteriorates and dies, then another body will grow and our self will be that body. As if the self may come back, but it's like a different self as a result of a different body. There are many different philosophies that people don't really understand, that the soul is quite amazing, very difficult to understand. But very difficult to understand is the difference between the self and the supreme self. So they seem to be in complete ignorance of, and generally we just in this world identify ourselves with this material body, whatever this, you know, whichever body the soul ends up, we understand that I am this body, and I am acting independently. That a dog is thinking that I am barking and chasing away, you know, intruders into my territory, and they mark out the territory. In the way that they do in my territory, anyone who comes into here, you know, so the dogs, you know, I'm performing this activity. And in the same way, actually, that the dogs are performing that activity, if a human identifies with the body, they're no better than the dog. That I am performing this activity independently. This is, but now, this. The previous verse to that, we read verse 14. But in the fifth chapter, again, in text 8 and 9, describes that a person in the divine consciousness, so one who knows that they're not the body but the soul, although engaged in seeing, hearing, touching, smelling, eating, moving about, sleeping and breathing, always knows within himself that he actually does nothing at all, because while speaking, evacuating, receiving, or opening and closing his eyes, he always knows that only the material senses are engaged with the objects and that he is aloof from them. That's quite a concept, actually, that we identify with the body, but actually the body is a machine that we are within. That machine is a product of the material energy, which is acting under the control of the Supreme Lord, and therefore we are not doing anything, just the material energy is doing everything. So, this, but you know, that takes a bit of meditation, doesn't it? You know, because I lift my arm, I think, oh, I'll just lift my arm. So, in cooperation with Krishna, we can do something under the influence of the spiritual energy, or by not cooperating with Krishna, we do something under the influence of the material energy. So, according to one's desires, one will enter one of 8,400,000 different species of life, and according to the body one enters, that body is completely controlled by the laws of material nature. One must act in a particular way. So a dog may be thinking, I am independently barking and chasing away my rivals, but actually, because he's taken birth in the body of a dog, which is given by the material nature, he must do that. The material energy is actually enacting those activities. He must. He has no, he's saying, I am doing this independently, but he has no choice. When you take birth in the body of a dog, you will bark like a dog. It's the rule of things the dogs do. So, of course, you know, there is a little independence. But, very little. Little independence is something. By and large, one is forced to act according to the situation one is in. So there are 8,400,000 different species of life, and according to one's desires, one is placed into those. So the beginning of this chapter described that the desires are unlimited. So Prabhupada says there's at least 8,400,000 different desires. But then, so for instance, in the body of the dog, so amongst the 8,400,000 different types of desires, that is one desire will get you into the body of the dog. But then there are many different varieties of dogs. Some like, you know, like you've got your border collie, you know, the border collie likes to run more. Some like to just sit more, you know, like that. Some like to chase other animals, like you. You know, the hyenas and what have you. You know, some, you know, a little bit savage, like the wolves. So, you know, the desires vary. So there's at least 8,400,000 species, but then that expands, you know. So, as it says, it's pretty much unlimited. So, but what is unique is that in each of the 8,400,000 different species of life, there's four things that they all do in common. Doesn't matter whether they take birth. You know, sometimes as Prabhupada says, you know, he's writing his books and you see the little dot, so you think it's a full stop, and it starts walking around the page. It's tiny little spot. You realize, well, that's a living entity. That living entity also has four propensities, which is eating. A little insect is about the size of the dot will eat. Rest, sleep, defend itself, in other words, you know, try to make a secure position. Do I stay on the folding pages? Or perhaps go to the edge? And sex life, for reproduction. That's common in all the different species of life. In fact, if you look at all the different 400,000 different species of life, you see that their entire lives revolve particularly around reproduction. So much of it. You know, their whole cycle of life culminates in reproducing the species. Okay. So that there is, so you see, for some animals, you know, to find a mate, to reproduce, it takes up so much energy, so much struggle, so much danger. But there is some, above all things, it impels them to the greatest degree above all things. But basically, sex life, you know, in all species, to one degree or another, is the most compelling force. So therefore, here, Srila Prabhupada describes that, you know, here, this city, on the outskirts of the city, there are many beautiful trees and creepers encircling a nice lake. Surrounding the lake are many groups of birds and bees. They're always chanting and humming. So it's describing that, as it says here, so the various parts of the body, those which incite sexual impulses, are referred to here indirectly. Favorable conditions surrounding the sex impulse are compared here to the garden or a nice solitary park. When one sees the opposite sex, naturally the sex impulse increases. So, in all species of life, you know, they have their mating rituals. They're quite bizarre, some of them. They're quite spectacular, some of them. But, you know, they
Like, you know, the peacocks that display the feathers, and some birds puff up their chests, and, you know, there's singing and some of the things, you know, in a particular season, what have you. So it's very similar. And, you know, for some living in the ocean, it's when the moon bites, you know, certain days of the moon. That just sets them all off by the moon, they just can't control themselves. And even corals, what have you. So, you know, this inhuman form of life, which we're most concerned with because we're human, so we can actually sit and hear this. So, unlike the little creature that walks around the page with the bow of the tongue, we can actually enter into the understanding of the bow of the tongue. And the other, so that little speck, he may be, you know, walking around the Bhagavad Gita and think, oh, he's so, you know, he must know the Bhagavad Gita very well, he's probably walked on every page. But actually there's nothing. There's no concept of even the page, the writing, or anything like that. There's a little food there, eat that, if he meets another little spot somewhere, oh, this could be interesting. So eating, sleeping, mating, defend. That's what he wanders around the Bhagavad Gita, all he thinks is eating, sleeping, mating, defend. But we, of course, we can hear the Bhagavatam, and we can actually, you know, take that transcendental knowledge and get out of the body from the system of life. So, this, just therefore, because in the, you know, life is in all societies organized in such a way as to control the sex urge for peace and within the within society, because if we perform actions in this world, as we've said, because the body is literally under the control of the material energy, which is controlled by Krishna, if we engage in activities, we will get a material reaction. And therefore, any sinful activities, you know, eating things we shouldn't eat, intoxication, gambling, this is such many things, will incur some suffering. So, you know, that was also described there, that the you know, we discussed that how is it that one in the divine consciousness, they understand that they're doing so many things to the body, but actually they're not doing anything. The next verse describes that one who performs his duty without attachment, surrendering the results to the Supreme Lord, is unaffected by sinful reaction, as the lotus leaf is untouched by water. And further on, it also describes that the steadily devoted soul attains unadulterated peace because he offers the result of all activities to me. Whereas a person who is not in union with the divine, who is greedy for the fruits of his labor, becomes entangled. So, these, the activities that we perform with the material body, they actually create a material reaction, and they also, you know, one desire produces so many other desires, and that produces our next body, and therefore we must suffer birth, death, old age, and disease. So, the one in human form of life, the activities that we perform, if we, one may not necessarily be self-realized, but the scriptures regulate our activities, so we're actually elevating and moving towards a level of existence where we're not increasing the suffering and the entanglement in the material world. So therefore, sex life is regulated. Otherwise, in this material body, unregulated material activities will produce the next body, and it just goes on unlimitedly. So it's like, and above all things, as it describes here, you know, that this sex life is so difficult to control. Prabhupada says, when one sees the opposite sex, naturally the sex impulse increases. It is said that if a man in a solitary place does not become agitated upon seeing a woman, he is to be considered a brahmachari. But this practice is almost impossible. So, you know, therefore, the above all things, eating, sleeping, mating, defending, as we said, the primary activity is this for animals' reproduction, which is sex life. And for humans, of course, even disregard the whole process of reproduction. They actually just captured by the sex desire itself. And this is very, very entangling, because very, very sinful. So, we see that what people will do, that sex life is so captivating that people will engage in the most abominable, risky, sinful, degraded, harmful, vicious activities, if somehow or another it increases their ability to have sex life. So here it's describing that, there are certain things which, for all species and humans, so humans, like any other animal, if they're not God conscious, they create external facility which, helps to impel sex life, both for themselves and for the person they're trying to incite to, sex life. So, for instance, we're coming up to the Melbourne Cup. Right? So, if you see advertisements for the Melbourne Cup, it's 90% fashion show. Right? It appears it's hardly about the horses. It's about going there and seeing beautiful women dressed up, the most beautiful women, dressed up in most beautiful clothing, all sorts of foods which shouldn't be, music, some of the best, they invited Taylor Swift to come and sing there, but she wouldn't do it because of the sinful activity involved. But they, it's all of this activity and money, as they say, obscene amounts of money, won and spent. They're very attractive, for people. So it's all, basically the, like here, the what is conducive for sex life. But to do that, they will engage in the most simple activities. So, actually the whole racing industry, like previously, the greyhound industry, was shut down completely because the cruelty, they were using live rabbits to train the greyhounds, and they'd catch them and tear them to pieces and things. And plus the cruelty to the dogs themselves. So now that's happening with the racing industry. A lot of it is coming out now, well timed, the activists and all the racists just before the Melbourne Cup. That what they've discovered is that they've suspected this for a long time, but now they have the proof that basically, they breed, perhaps 14,000 racehorses per year or something. It was a phenomenal amount. So then they had this policy which came about through also the greyhounds, because when they're not wanting, they basically kill them off. So with the horses, they have what's called horse wastage. Horse wastage means that when you run a horse for 3 or 4 years, and you can't, you know, it's not going to run anymore, or you, it, you know, you may have a season and you can sell it off to someone who then will have to get rid of it. So then, what to do with the horses they just don't want? There's 14,000 out. In the statistics, there's about 5,000 a year which just disappear. Right? This is the new controversy, because what they found is that these horses are ending up in the abattoirs. Yeah. And so what happens is that, you know, rather than keep the horse and eat the good grass, which the new horses have eaten, and some things, and feed and look after and pay all the veterinary costs and what have you. Although it's written in the, you know, the rules of racing, they must, as a result of the greyhound scandal in horse racing as well, they must look after these animals for the rest of their life. They actually must be cared for. So, but what they're finding is that they're actually listed on the computer as active and racing, and yet they've actually been dead for a long time. They've actually been taken to the slaughterhouse. And of course, they have these, animal liberation. It's a very, very expert day for all these films of the, inside the slaughterhouse, and they film their brain and they can name literally the horses, they can, because it's brain beyond the chip and everything. And so they can just say, this is disgraceful, this is what they want. So, that's a big scam. But so much sinful activity, so much in. I think if anyone who's going to the races once saw that the horses that they're watching to facilitate my sex life and, fashion, beauty, and eating something, probably the next year they will be sent to the slaughterhouse. The journey to the slaughterhouse is excruciating, and some of them end up underneath a whole lot of horses, and they basically, they have to drag them out by the head. They just, then they get them into the slaughterhouse, and of course they sometimes have to shoot them 4 or 5 times, and in between that, they problem with in the general, actually, some time in the aims with electric shocks, and they beat them and swerve them and so on. Very quick kick them and some of the all these things on film. If people saw that this is the sinful activity that supports my enjoying my senses, or one outing, going on an outing, one can, that horse, that's its fate, so I can enjoy that. So, very, very simple. But the people who, so therefore there's so much cover-ups and so many things. It's very, very demoniac. As Prabhupada said, I was listening to a lecture weeks ago, Prabhupada said, currently, the world is being ruled by, in the various countries, the world is being ruled by rakshasas. So, but, the point is, how much, simple activity, how much trouble one will go, how can people give up their sex life when they're doing this sort of activity to just increase their chances of their sex life? If that's what they do, that's the sort of thing that they will, that's the extent of what they will do, even the so-called civilized humans, to facilitate a little sense of it. And you ask them to give it up. They lie, they cheat, they steal, they kill. So that's why Prabhupada says, it's not possible. As we see in these verses of the again, if you see the verses of same 5th chapter, that describes that in verse 23 and 20, 22, it describes it, an intelligent person does not take part in the sources of misery, which are due to contact with the material senses. Such pleasures have a beginning and an end, and so the wise man is not delighted. So, by hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita, you know, we come to our senses that actually, just like so many different species of life, we've got this body which is a machine which is being controlled by the material energy. And if we're not careful how we act in this life, it will produce another material body within those 8,400,000 different species. Even taking birth as a human, as we see on this planet, is very, very risky. There's billions and billions of human beings. I would be terrified to take birth in that place, in that body, on this planet right now. And so, but it describes that. The liberated person is not attracted to material sense pleasure, but is always in trance, enjoying the pleasure within. In this way, the self-realized person enjoys unlimited happiness, for he concentrates on the Supreme. So actually, what we hear from the Srimad Bhagavatam is that if we turn our attention to the proprietor of the body, the actual owner and committer of the body, that we can actually live in a transcendental loving relationship with that person after body death. And then all our activities, although we're acting with the body, the mind and the words, if we don't identify with the body, but we identify as the soul acting for the purpose of serving the personality of Godhead, although the body is acting, actually we have nothing to do with the action or the reaction. And one enjoys transcendental pleasure within. So, for instance, just like Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada followed in the footsteps of Arjuna, that he only acted for the pleasure of the Supreme Lord and his representatives. And you can just imagine Srila Prabhupada's transcendental pleasure as he acted to give this knowledge. The Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, all over the world, and saw temples coming up and books going out, Shouting going out and people being liberated. We can barely, you know, understand that transcendental pleasure having and always being accompanied by Krishna, the personality of Godhead, just like Arjuna. Arjuna, from, you know, even from childhood, his life consisted in pleasing Krishna, his friend. And he acted as an instrument in the hands of his friend. And Krishna, that relationship between the Supreme Soul, as we said, there are two numbers in the body, that also within the body is the Super Soul. And he actually directs the wanderings of all living beings, especially and directly directs the activities of the devotees. So like Arjuna, Krishna was personally on his chariot. Throughout the course of Arjuna's whole life, whenever he had to make decisions or whenever there was a big milestone events, his marriage, this other, the other, Krishna was there at every step directing Arjuna, helping him to get this, enjoy life to the fullest extent. As we see in the Bhagavad Gita, 922, Prabhupada says that for those who are fully devoted to me, I personally carry what they lack and deserve what they have. Srila Prabhupada says a devotee should never think if they serve Krishna, engage in Krishna, that there will ever be any scarcity or unhappiness. If one takes to the service of Krishna, there will always be abundance and transcendental bliss. That's what we see. That's what we see in the life of Srila Prabhupada and the charis and the devotees. So that is this body, which is a machine, is also sometimes compared to, you have the five senses compared. compared to five horses. And so, which is, you know, very interesting, because the body is like the chariot, the horses are the five senses, the reins are the mind, the driver is the intelligence, and the soul is the passenger. Although there's another passenger, that's the unseen friend, that's Krishna, there's another passenger. And but those five senses, you know, it's very interesting. Usually we just think of the body, it's the whole thing. But actually, you know, you really have to think in terms of the senses, because, you know, one horse may lead the others. Or one horse may be defective, you know. The body, you have to really look at it. So, and in human form of life, especially, all five horses are very powerful, very active. But the driver, which is like the intelligence, is taking control of the mind, which is directing the senses. That's the proper way. Otherwise, for those who are dictated by the senses, the horses are pulling away at the reins, and the driver has lost control, and the chariot is going over a cliff. But we see that Krishna took the reins of Arjuna's chariot. So, in other words, when one takes direction of the scripture, it is just like Krishna taking the reins of the chariot of Arjuna. He becomes our intelligence. In other words, that's what's called becoming one with Krishna. He has his individuality, we have our individuality, but Krishna actually personally assists that both in the same chariot, and Krishna is personally taken. Where do you want me to go, Arjuna? Take me here in the battle of Kurukshetra. Krishna is following the instructions of Arjuna. Take me here. And he is doing it very expertly. But if there's any danger, because he's the personality of God here, he also has, he can protect Arjuna. This is our position. Although Krishna allows us that little independence to use our own intelligence in the service of Krishna in a very individual way, but as the driver, the chariot of our body, by giving us intelligence, he is always, we're working with him hand in hand. And that transcendental friendship in spreading Krishna consciousness, that joy is what the transcendentalists see. And although they're engaged with the body mind words, they're actually completely liberated even within this body. So I'll just leave it there. If anyone has any questions or comments about any of that.
Just commenting, like you were saying about the horse races, and so I guess coming up this time of year, sometimes I have to drive people there. That's my worst. Like, I hate that the most. Because it's just such a illusory kind of mood. It's like the worst kind of people, like very bad character.
The material world, its nature is very entangled. And therefore, we really have to take show of Krishna's intelligence that we can, look after the body, because we don't neglect the body, look after our body, make preparations for family if we're doing that, need income. But to do that and not be entangled, we must take direction from Krishna and the devotees. We never ever stop hearing from Krishna and the devotees. Otherwise, the nature of the world, without Krishna giving that direction, as you can see, we're just trying to earn an honest living or something, and we just become implicated in this kind of simple activity. So, it's very important to always be hearing. as Prabhupada said, the idea is to catch the fish, so we have these fish in the pond, but if we can eat them, we might want to catch some fish and put them in a pond. Sometimes the birds come and eat them, or he gets them all. The idea is to catch the fish, not get wet. Sometimes you have to take the fish out to clean the pond. I noticed there was a dead bird there the other day. But sometimes we have to take the fish out and clean out the pond. The idea is to catch the fish, not dead weight. So the idea is to do your work, not get implicated. And that can be attractive.
And Krishna says in third chapter that the nature of the soul is to be active.
Yes.
He thinks that's from there. Because the nature of the soul is to be active, he has to act and bring about reactions.
That's right. And you know, therefore, we've got to act in a liberated way. There's some really nice statements, just very briefly, just to summarize, I just want to mention something here about liberation. How quickly we can actually come to that point by the grace of hearing from Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. One thing. Purport to 442, fourth chapter, text number 42. Really nice sentence by Srila Prabhupada. It says, the Lord is definitely the supreme person and his activities are transcendental. One who understands this is a liberated person from the very beginning of his study of Bhagavad Gita. Such a nice instruction. So even Prabhupada says, just hypothetically accepted. You don't fully understand it, but you've got to read the Gita in that line that Krishna is the supreme person of God. Not that we are one with God, we're supreme, there is other. There is a personality of God here, his name is Krishna, and he is supreme. If you read the Bhagavad Gita in that way, from the very beginning of your study of the Bhagavad Gita, you are liberated. And Prabhupada clarified that one time in Hyderabad, 1974. He said that, if you know Krishna as the supreme personality of God, you immediately jump forward in your liberation 50%. So then he gives a percentage. Right? So you're liberated from the beginning. If you read Bhagavad Gita and accept, you're the authority, Krishna. So I'm reading this from the supreme authority and I'm reading it like that. No interpretation. What you've said, that's good enough. From the very beginning of your study of the Gita, you're liberated. And as soon as you, not hypothetically, but you're saying yes, there is God, Krishna is that supreme person, I've got it, immediately jump forward 50%. So it's not that hard, it all comes down to hearing and constantly purify the heart, and that is bhakti, means that the senses become purified and engaged in the master, so the senses jive. So the Prabhupada teacher,